Welcome to the Reorg Primary Review, where we cover the latest developments in high yield, distressed debt, and bankruptcy, and feature discussions on issues affecting distressed debt, leverage finance, direct lending, high yield bonds, high yield municipals, covenants, private credit, and middle market companies. I'm David Zupkis. This week, Seth Brumby, Deputy Managing Editor at Reorg, and David Dowden, Managing Director at Mackay Shields, discuss muni bonds with a focus on the high-yield muni bond market and how the shifting interest rate environment has affected bonds issued under the Build America Bond Program. And as always, we bring you our weekly summary of interesting developments in the restructuring world, as well as a preview of what's on tap for next week. We'd love to hear your feedback to help us improve the podcast experience, so please take a moment to complete the short survey at the link attached to this podcast and let us know how we're doing. It's Monday, April 15th.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Primary View. My name is Seth Brumby. I'm Deputy Managing Editor at Reorg. And we've had an interesting couple of days. We had an earthquake in New York City on Friday, followed by the eclipse on Monday. We're recording this podcast on Tuesday, April 9th, and I in the New York Times that there are cicadas now coming. So it sounds like we have three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. We'll see what the rest of the year brings. But for now, we're going to talk about municipal debt. And I have joining me today David Dowden, Managing Director at Mackay Shields, who was with us this time last year. David, it is always a pleasure. Welcome back to the Primary View.
Thank you very much. And I'll say, if those are the four horsemen, your salvation will be municipal bonds. So just rest assured.
They are a safe haven in tumultuous times. Well, we've actually had a great first quarter here. There is some silver lining to what were two awful years, 2022 and 2023. I want to especially highlight the performance for high yield municipal bonds, which have so far returned even more than corporate high yield. David, can you give us the backdrop for this?
Sure, absolutely. I think it's worth taking a step back to last year. High yield held in very well for the first 6 months of last year. The third quarter got a little difficult as we started to see some, rotation of the deck chairs among some of the big managers in high yield, and that put some redemption pressure in our market. In the fourth quarter, commencing in November, the market took off like a rocket, and the longer duration aspect of muni high yield definitely supported that part of the market in terms of producing strong results. Now, coming into this year, we knew that we were going to see ongoing strong demand for high yield munis in a market where there's really been a lack of adequate supply. We have some new entities in the market that are buyers, institutional entities that are buyers of high yield. And I think most important, on top of those positive technicals, we have strong fundamentals through most of the municipal bond market. So credit is in very good position. And certainly when we think about the outlook from an economic standpoint, it indicates that investors should rightly have some confidence in putting money to work in the high yield muni space.
And from an, I guess, buyer's perspective here, do you think discretion will be rewarded, or is this pretty much a market that's just gotten so frothy you have to put money to work?
I think discretion is always rewarded. We've seen patterns in our market historically where if you take a kind of, a broad brush approach to just acquiring muni high yield, you're going to pick up some problems along the way. I speak with bias. We are a fundamental credit shop. We are oriented to identifying relative value in our market. And as such, our view is that, regardless of kind of what you're seeing in the technicals and in the fundamentals, on a bond by bond basis, you still need to be looking at it and making a determination whether that specific bond, that specific issuer represents good value.
And taking a look back over the past couple of years, we clearly noted that the rise in interest rates brought bond prices back down to earth. This actually set up an environment starting this year, which I find to be interesting, particularly as it relates to Build America bonds, which have grabbed headlines over the past couple of months. Build America bonds, which we call affectionately BABs, these were taxable debt issued back at the financial crisis, And even though they've been around for about 10 or 15 years, they're all sitting front and center for a lot of people. But David, can you give us a sense of what the taxable market was like and how Build America Bonds helped evolve it?
Sure, absolutely. Pre the financial crisis, there were always taxable municipal bonds out there. Typically, issuance in a given year was inside of 10%. It was a market that was probably most used for pension obligation bonds. And on those occasions where you had a municipal issuer issuing debt for what were considered to be non-municipal purposes, typically you had maybe a for-profit entity involved in the financing. With the financial crisis, one of the concerns the federal government had in speaking with state and local governments was what was going to be their access, their capacity to access the capital markets. And a solution put forward was the development of the Build America Bond Program, wherein municipal issuers that would typically be in issuing tax-exempt debt would issue taxable bonds. Now, they're taxable, so they're going to have a higher interest rate on them. But what the federal government said was, that's okay. We're going to go ahead and give you a subsidy of 35% to cover that that incremental cost. And this is going to give you breadth to a much broader array of investors in the market. And that's exactly what we saw. And what we specifically observed was that a lot of foreign investors out of Europe and Asia, who have a great familiarity with sub-sovereign debt, looked at the muni market really for the first time in these BAB structures and said, wow, here we have sub-sovereign credits. They tend to be relative to corporate bonds, much higher bias for high quality. They tend to have a relatively lower correlation to other taxable sectors of the market. So in general, for kind of the ag type investors in the market, this was an opportunity to add a new sector that reduced risk. Many of the credits have monopoly-like aspects to them. These were all very appealing factors, and foreign ownership of BABs was quite extensive. But the BAB program had an expiration date. It had a sunset, and that sunset came, and we didn't see any more production. In 2017, when tax cuts were put through, one of the funding mechanisms for that was the elimination, the advance refunding option in the tax-exempt municipal bond market. But because interest rates had come down so substantially, it was actually economic for many municipal issuers to go ahead and issue taxable municipal bonds and use the proceeds of that issuance to effect a refunding of their tax-exempt debt, which is what they went ahead and did. This then took issuance up to over 25% of the market and brought in all those non-traditional investors once again back into the taxable muni market, who got a flavor of the benefits of munis when they bought BABs, and now they were able to buy taxable bonds in general.
Okay. And then I guess that subsidy, though, was affected by the Budget Control Act of, I'm going to say 2011, but it wasn't implemented until 2013. This was commonly known as sequestration. And as part of the sequestration, that subsidy was reduced, which kind of leads us to where we are now with regard to a lot of notices of refundings of Build America bonds and subsequent offering memorandums too. And it seems to me like when I look at some of the bond documents, the provisions for redemptions can have several different flavors. And it seems like a lot of the issuers want to use an extraordinary redemption provision. Can you define that for us, David?
Sure. What is happening is that we are seeing issuers looking to affect the extraordinary redemption provision. And in some cases, they are pointing to the fact of sequestration as the driving factor for that. What this means is that if successful, they are basically taking their bonds back early. And then it really becomes, from a relative value standpoint, a function of what a given owner of BABs has in their portfolio. because the ERP provisions vary from security to security. The question that is in the market today is, given that this has been an ongoing issue, the sequestration for quite a while, is that appropriate? That's a question that's being posed out there in the market today.
Okay. And until we get some resolution on that, it still seems as though just the question of having extraordinary redemptions, or ERP as you call it, is affecting supply. Can you give us a sense of just how taxable municipal bonds are benefiting from the current environment? I mean, it sounds like BEP sort of whetted everyone's appetite for taxable debt. And now that we can see that they're actually kind of more geared towards retail and retirement plans. So what can investors do today in terms of taking advantage of taxable municipal debt?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this has been we're witnessing the evolution of a new market segment. The first pass of that was the creation of BABs and the ownership of BABs by foreign investors. Those investors who had the greatest kind of experience with sub-sovereign debt. Today, with the growth of taxable munis in general, we saw those investors once again at the forefront initially. But the reality is there's great potential in the domestic market as well. And, certainly I think you hit the nail on the head. One of those areas is for individual investors, many of whom probably have had pretty positive experience in owning tax-exempt municipal bonds, are now having the opportunity to use taxable municipal bonds within their retirement portfolios, which makes sense because you're not paying taxes in your retirement portfolio. It's a tax-deferred vehicle. And all those attributes I mentioned earlier for taxable munis work very well for these type of for individual investors to better diversify their portfolios. Likewise, on the institutional side of the market, we have other institutions that are in a similar position where they are not subject to taxation. Think pension funds, endowments that are not not-for-profits. These entities don't look at investments from a tax standpoint. So historically, they really haven't looked at the muni market. They too, I think, can look at the taxable muni market and think about it as another opportunity to layer in a diversified credit strategy.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. I always take a look at some Federal Reserve disclosures that do talk a little bit about the growing diversification of the buyer base in the municipal market. And I've always found it interesting that the trend line, particularly for foreign buyers or from overseas banks, has always steadily increased as a share of the market. And I guess we'll continue to see that evolve.
Yeah, no, I think that aspect of it is going to be a reflection. You know, sometimes when you look at the Fed data, you've got to kind of drill through whether that's direct end ownership of the securities or that represents their activity as a trader in the market. And I think that obviously what can be a rate limiting component of that is what's happening in the currency markets. Because obviously these investors from overseas hedge, and as hedging costs, in periods where hedging costs are rising, that can diminish the level of demand for taxable munis. That's why the longer term, I think the domestic US market for kind of what we would call non-traditional muni investors is probably where we're gonna see the greatest potential for growth. Also, if you think about it, taxable munis are a part of our market that's very oriented to infrastructure. And for a lot of investors in the US, there's a great appreciation and demand for looking for opportunities to be involved in investing in infrastructure projects. This, I think, it makes it a good fit.
All right. Well, David, your insights are always appreciated. And I always learn a lot, too, with our conversation. I'll welcome you back next year, this time, to see how the market has done. But in the meantime, take care, everybody, and be careful of those cicadas.
For in-court coverage this week, we take a look at 99 Cent Stores, Bosch Health, Amneal Pharmaceuticals, Robert Shaw, Diamond Sports Group, T-Hum Care Services, and Rite Aid. Discount retailer 99 Cent Only Stores filed Chapter 11 last Sunday in the bankruptcy court for the District of Delaware. In furtherance of a pre-petition notice that was closing all stores, the company said it aims to wind down retail operations and continue marketing all its assets via the Section 363 sale process. Judge Kate Stickles held a first-day hearing on Wednesday and Thursday last week, ultimately approving the company's interim access to a $60.8 million DIP financing facility from TC Lending, a pre-petition FILO lender and Sixth Street affiliate. The interim DIP order gives the debtors access to $20.5 million of new money. During the hearing, the debtors announced a resolution of potential DIP objection from the ad hoc secured noteholder group, which also made a competing DIP proposal. Debtors' counsel did not describe the competing offer, but said the debtors have not yet responded as of Thursday. The Court of Appeals to the Federal Circuit issued an opinion on Thursday affirming a Delaware federal court's decision prohibiting the U.S. Food and Drug Administration from approving Norwich Pharmaceuticals' amended abbreviated new drug application, or ANDA, for a generic Xifaxan competitor until October 2029. However, the appellate court also affirmed the district court's decision to invalidate certain patents covering Xifaxan held by Bosch subsidiary Salix Pharmaceuticals. Separately, Bosch and Salix continued their campaign to defend Xifaxan from generic competition by filing a new suit on Friday, April 5th, against Amneal Pharmaceuticals. The complaint alleges that Amneal's ANDA for a generic version of 550 milligrams Xifaxan tablets infringes several Salix patents different from the ones invalidated by the Delaware court. Judge Christopher Lopez granted the Robert Shaw debtors' request to stay Invesco's state court suit challenging a December 2023 transaction that eliminated Invesco's required lender status and handed control over the company's restructuring to the ad hoc group of Bain, Canyon, and Eaton Vance. During a bench ruling on Monday, Judge Lopez found that the debtors' automatic stay applies to claims against non-debtors because Invesco seeks to unwind an amendment to the pre-petition credit agreement, and the debtors have a property interest in that amendment. In statements filed on Wednesday, the National Basketball Association and the National Hockey League expressed concern that the Diamond Sports Group's reorganization efforts are not proceeding quickly enough for the regional sports network owner to emerge sufficiently in advance of their 2024-2025 league seasons. The NBA says that it cannot afford to wait much longer to learn whether the debtors will in fact have a viable business to emerge as a going concern, while the NHL bemoans a lack of certainty that the debtors will emerge from bankruptcy and distribute NHL games. Judge Christopher Lopez issued a key bench ruling on Thursday in the Tehum Care Texas two-step case. The judge denied the official committee of tort claimants' motion to dismiss the case, finding evidence of valid bankruptcy purposes despite the TCC's stance that the case is an abuse of Chapter 11. Judge Lopez also rejected the debtor's proposed global settlement with the official committee of unsecured creditors and non-debtor affiliates, however, finding the deal was in substance a restructuring support agreement where parties agreed on a proposed Chapter 11 plan. On Monday, the Rite Aid debtors announced they intend to pursue the plan restructuring instead of a sale transaction under their proposed Chapter 11 plan. Debtors had until April 8th to publicize which path they had chosen under their dual-track plan. Spirit Airlines, Better Health Group, Sound Inpatient Physicians, and Converge One round out this week's crop of near-term restructurings and refinancings and new advisor mandates. Spirit Airlines could face significant cost increases if inflationary pressures related to new labor contracts persist, and Spirit potentially has to match the high pay rates and generous benefits recently negotiated by other airlines. Spirit Airlines faces $1.1 billion of loyalty bonds due in 2025. Alternatively, since Spirit has a short-term contract in place, the recent labor negotiations with other airlines could bode well for Spirit if the industry-wide rise in labor costs leads to carriers raising prices to maintain margins. Better Health Group, formerly known as Physician Partners, reported that fourth quarter 2023 cash EBITDA fell significantly year over year. Margins are expected to be under pressure this year, and the company is facing potential cash burn as the healthcare provider is harmed by the lower than expected payment rate increase for Medicare Advantage plans in 2025 announced last week. Sound Physicians is closing in on a pro rata liability management transaction to receive new money and execute a debt exchange to address the company's upcoming debt maturities. Timing of such a transaction is fluid, but a deal could be launched and cleansed in the next month. Minority first lien lenders to Converge One are organizing with Proskauer Rose's legal advisor as they are left out of 35% of an equity rights offering. Non-pro rata treatment of creditors in the same class was a hot topic in recent years. Top red stories this week included Global Liability Management Quarterly. Altice France asset drop downs galvanized investors into organizing. Rackspace up-tier exchange less aggressive than GoTo Group and Apex Tools. Parties settle Robert Shaw up-tier challengers. Vedanta consent provides about 2 years extra time. WHOA versus Part 26A, the future of parallel proceedings in the wake of McDermott's restructuring. Jay Alick's response to defendant's motion to dismiss suit, arguing he is real party in interest. Defendant's arguments unfounded. Court denies Kirkland's bid to push Rico's suit dismissal hearing to profit lead counsel Huestin's schedule. Kate Thomas is on vacation, so I'll be bringing you the week ahead for the week of Monday, April 15th. On Monday, the Westco debtors will be in court to seek approval of a disclosure statement supplement containing updated valuation analysis, financial projections, and a liquidation analysis. The debtors will be back in court on Wednesday and Thursday for days 23 and 24 of the Westco in court trial on the validity of the debtors' 2022 up-tier transaction, which forms the basis of the debtors' plan. On Tuesday, the Gemini Global debtors' comprehensive settlement with former lending partner Gemini Trust Company, the ad hoc group of lenders, and the official unsecured creditors committee will be up for court approval. According to the debtors, the deal would facilitate near-term recovery to approximately 97% on an in-kind basis to Gemini lenders and eliminate the need to establish a litigation reserve. On Wednesday, the Joann Stores debtors' second day hearing takes place. Debtors will seek final approval of their $142 million dip-to-exit facility provided by a group of pre-petition secure creditors and additional financing parties with Wilmington Savings Fund Society FSB as agent. Diamond Sports Group debtors will also be on court on Wednesday to seek disclosure statement approval of their going concern plan of reorganization on a contested basis. Objectors, the NBA and NHL question the debtors' ability to merge before the 2024-2025 season since the debtors have yet to secure long-term broadcasting deals with their leagues and club partners and long-term carriage agreements with distributors. The MLB in turn challenges the debtors' projections for their direct-to-consumer business because the projections lack necessary details to assess reasonableness. On Thursday, the Thrasio debtors and the Charismatic debtors will be in court for contested disclosure statement approval hearings. The debtors' disclosure statements face significant opposition from their respective official unsecured creditors' committees for lacking key information. The Thrasio debtors intend to revise their DS before the hearing, while the Charismatic debtors are working on a resolution with their UCC. On Friday, the Kuro Group debtors will be asking for final approval of a $70 million new money debt facility, $60 million of which is provided by First Lien lenders and $7 million by OCO Capital. Also on Friday, in Robert Shaw, Judge Christopher Lopez will take up former controlling lender Invesco's motion for the bankruptcy court to abstain or transfer venue of its state court suit challenging a December 2023 transaction. The transaction enabled the debtors to prepay Invesco's first out loans and hand control of the company's restructuring to the ad hoc group of Bain, Canyon, Eaton, Vance. Invesco will also face off equity sponsor One Rock's attempt to obtain a judgment on the pleadings on Invesco's tortious interference claims. Thank you again for tuning in to the REARC Primary Review and our weekly review. Find all our podcasts on the REARC.com webinars and podcast page, as well as Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Amazon. Take care and see you all next week.